This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
This project was very much influenced by a woman named Barbara Smith, which people may not have heard of, who wrote a series of analyses of poetic structure and rhythmic poetry and other sorts of examination of the structure of poetry about 35 years ago. And in her book, Poetic Closure, she says this: although a lyric may imitate logical discourse, that is not what it is, and the reader's experience will be determined by the fact that he ultimately responds to the poem as something other than a piece of reasoning. Now, if we were to start a little debate about what that other would be, I'm sure it would be pretty lively. We don't really have to agree on what that other thing is. But what this does is capture the essential problem of a computer program that's going to generate texts, in particular aesthetic texts. Now, how do you find that thing that conveys meaning other than through reason? Okay. And I want to start here in answering that question by treating treating the production of literary text as a process. Right. Now, my students from my systems design class will notice the similarity between this and particularly the unified process, but a methodology associated with the development of computer programs, right, where we start with some kind of inception, work through planning, drafting, revision, and then ultimately a release to the public. Right. Now, you could argue that my bias towards system development has influenced this, but you could also argue that any making activity involves these phases. Right? But why I want to have them here is kind of examine for a minute the way computers aid these various phases, right, as a way of starting this conversation. So over here in publication and performance, this is pretty obvious right now. Over the last few years, the kind of thing that Nick has been working on, right, with a number of his colleagues, the publication of poetry and conceptual art on the web. Right? Either as static pages or as flash presentations or dynamic HTML or JavaScript. It's kind of very, very vigorous and energized ways of presenting textual art to the public. Right? There's been a plethora of online journals, and as recently as 2 or 3 years ago, publishing in an online journal was kind of a second-rate way to go. Now some of these online journals are becoming more exclusive than paper journals. A Jacket, for example, is a pretty, it's been around for a while. You can't submit an unsolicited poem to Jacket. I mean, it's by invitation only. Right? So, they're getting even more arrogant in things like the Minnesota Review, for Christ's sake. Right? All right, so we have this. Computers aid us here. And this is, much less sexy, drafting and revision, but for a long time we've been using a computer to aid us there. Right? Word processor was a boon to poets. But suddenly, now, I'll say we, right, so that I can live in the same club that Bob does, right? But I'm neither a poet nor a computer scientist. You understand that I am a coder, right, and a system integrator, right? I use the computer to solve practical problems. That's what I do. Right? But I'm going to use we anyway. Right? So when we discovered the word processor, now suddenly, of enormous benefit is the what you see is what you get feature of all word processors these days. So we could see what the final product on a printed page would look like on our computer screen or print it out. So we no longer had to guess if italics were appropriate. I still have my Remington Silent Writer, right, and it still works. Right? And if we wanted to italicize them, we had to underline it. Right? And how's that going to look on a printed page? We don't know. We're stuck with the Elite or Pica font, which was fixed. So we had no idea what that was going to look like on the printed page. So, I actually accidentally published a few things many years ago when I was still good looking. And I was always a shock as to what it looked like in the journal, right, compared to the printed page. So this, and the fact that we can move things around, we can edit, we can do a draft, print it out, save off multiple drafts, I mean, that's been just an enormous, right, improvement in productivity from just those kinds of tools. But over here in the planning phase, this we could also argue that this is what our English 101 students are supposed to learn how to do, right? And somehow when they get to me at the Wharton School, they haven't, as I'm not quite sure it's going there. But we expect people to plan in compositions. Now here's where the computer, the library has become the resource of last resort, right? Now we can do research online. We can check our facts online, right? We can check history online. We can check influences online. We can, online book texting. We can do our reading online. And on those rare occasions when we actually do need something printed, we can use an online resource to ask the library to photocopy the journal article and send it to us in the intercampus mail, and we get it, right? So the computer is enormously useful in these phases. But back here, almost none, right? Here, this, of all of these, and I don't mean to pretend for a second that these later phases don't require resourcefulness and creativity, right? But here, that's imagination, right? Now, I'm a pretty good editor, right? If I have a text, I can make some suggestions, and I can make that text better, but I have a lousy imagination, right? If I could just get the computer to help me with that, I could start this entire process. Right. So that's what we're going to try to do, is to see if that will work. Right. Now, there are some obstacles to this. Now, if you do a Google search on poetry generator, you're going to get close to 5,000 hits. And you'll come and you'll see these little toy poetry generation systems. And they're kind of interesting, but it's not the kind of thing you want to return to. Right. And I'll talk a little bit about why that is and shortly. But these are the obstacles that prevent a really robust computationally based imagination. And that the first two here, novelty and variation. Right? How do you get something that's original? And now that seems like it ought to be a simple problem. So the people who are standing, we have some chairs over here. Okay, you're fine, okay. There you go, let's see, okay. It seems like it ought to be a simple problem. We've got the language, right? And if we just mix up the words, I mean, isn't originality a novel sequencing of words? Right? So let's just mix up some words. And that ought to give us some interesting texts, right? Well, and the problem with that is, and this I took this from the document that's posted on the website for this, if that were the case, then simply randomizing text would also produce new meaning, but it doesn't. The result is always gibberish, as shown here by the results of feeding this sentence to a token randomizer. And so you see the sentences that follow have those words randomized. Not only they don't make sense, worse, they're uninteresting. So token simply then new, always text produced, shown that it meaning also sentence, this results case, if, but the doesn't, the gibberish, da da da, and so on. The only thing that's remotely interesting is this, the is then. Right? So that could compete with Bob and the other language posts.
That's a quote from Stevens. The man on the dump and the
dump. Okay, all right. I knew that. Okay, all right. Okay. So that's not a solution. There's kind of an interim solution, and that's to extract sequences of words from existing texts. Right, rather than randomizing the language, let's listen. And John Cage, and you don't have to know who John Cage was. Part of the difficulty in having a talk like this is that I'm speaking to two audiences. I'm speaking to computer scientists, and I'm speaking with artists and literary scholars. And I am condemned, right, to seem hopelessly sophomoric to half of the audience at any given time, and to the other half, hopelessly arcane and esoteric. Right? So we'll all get to the same place at the end of this talk, but I may lose a few of you from time to time along the way. So John Cage and Jackson McLow and some other people like that who took existing texts and extracted strings of words from them and reassembled them in interesting ways to present new texts. Right? And that works. And Marjorie Perloff has a really interesting analysis of John Cage's work. I think it's analysis of what you say, and she traces the history of these mesostics that he wrote, which were these reassemblings of text. Right? and that they work because these recontextualizations are actually resulting in something new. Okay? But they're not generating language. Okay? And the reason they work, this is very subtle, is that in addition to extracting the words from the existing text, they're also extracting a part of the grammar. Right? So when you pull out a chunk, instead of individual words to reassemble, as you did in the sentence that I just had up there, we're pulling out the sequence of those words, which is the essence of grammar, which gives them some sense. Okay? So that's why we have some meaning. So we're pulling a lot. You can almost the image of you pulling this out, and they're trailing capillaries and nerves, and they've left part of themselves behind, and we've gotten them, and we reassemble them. Okay. Where we run into difficulty with that is very quickly, the text starts to be repetitive. Because if we have a text of 1,000 words and we're extracting bits of it and trying to reassemble, pretty soon we're going to start to repeat what we've done. Right? And we expect our poetry to be varied. And that's not. So there's a partial solution. And evidence that that's the fact, I've never heard anyone say, I wish someone would write another volume of Mesostics because I would really like to buy that and read it. Okay? The concept is interesting, the text less so. Right? So the last problem we face here is one of compositional cohesion. How do we get something that seems like a composition or generating it randomly? Right? So if we have, a group of words, the fact that they're random may make them interesting, but they don't coalesce. Right? So that's a problem that we need to figure out how to solve. Right? And we've been here, we go right through that. Now one place we can look for insights into how to solve this problem is the field of natural language generation, which is a subfield of computational linguistics. And it's interested in generating language that people can read. Okay. An example of a natural language generation system is the weather channels. Every 10 minutes they cycle the local weather. And you'll see there'll be text up on the screen, the current temperature is or whatever, and then they have the 36-hour forecast. Tonight the low will be 32 degrees. There may be a wind chill in there, there may be some other things. There's no one sitting somewhere at a computer typing those words. What is happening is that the weather data exists in a database, and there's a natural language generation system that plugs those values into text, and then they're displayed. And if you notice, the text varies. If the temperature is below a certain value, then there will be a wind chill. If it's above a certain value, there'll be a heat index. All right? So the language varies according to conditions. Okay. Now, the way these systems work, and we're looking at this to see if we can have some insight in how to build an aesthetic text generator, is they typically have these four components. We'll talk about them, the first three as one, and then we'll talk about the semantic grammar later. A document planner, a micro planner, and a surface realizer. Now, the document planner, its purpose is to create a document plan. And what that is pretty much what it sounds like, a composition. We're going to say this first, we're going to say this next, we're going to say this third, and we're going to conclude with this. Right? And very often those are simply templates with blanks to be filled in from data from someplace. Other times they are sets of rules. And we want to talk about this, and we're constrained by certain parameters in doing that. So when that's done, that gets passed off to the microplanner, and the microplanner's purpose is to write the individual utterances. And I'm going to use this term utterance tonight, but you can replace it with sentence or whatever, but I'm going to use the term utterance because that'll include things like phrases and fragments. It's a discrete piece of text with a beginning and an end, kind of a subtext. So the microplanner creates the semantic string. Then that gets passed off to a surface realizer, and the purpose of the surface realizer is to rationalize the grammar, the usage, perform subject-verb agreement, pronoun antecedent agreement, normalize the determiners, capitalize the sentence, punctuate the sentence, and those kinds of things, and make it presentable to the outside world. So those are kind of the three stages. Now, the thing that makes all that possible is what's called a semantic grammar. And I'm going to illustrate that by example more than trying to explain what it is. Say when we had a court reporting system where we were going to create text to give to the local newspaper for press releases on people who have been charged with various crimes. Right? So that's a constitutional right to have our names in the paper when we're arrested so that we don't... it is a constitutional right, because without that, then we could be arrested and held and no one would know. Right? So this is an administrative burden on the court system. So we can write a computer program to take care of that for us. We don't have to write this every day. Right? So if we look at these verbs, arrested, charged, arraigned, and convicted, you know, they address the same problem, the same linguistic problem, but arrested takes the preposition for, charged with, arraigned on, and convicted of. And you couldn't say convicted with shoplifting. It simply doesn't make sense. All right, so in order to have our NLG system make use of this, in the database, we could do different things. We could say the verb isn't arrested, the verb is arrested for. So we're attaching some grammar to the semantics. Okay? Or we might say, you know, we might have a column in the database that says, you know, with a foreign key. A foreign key just simply means that a particular entity, a particular value exists in some other table and it's referenced from the current table. So we just might have a reference to a preposition table that says for this verb use this preposition, for this one this one. And then I threw this in here so we can see that it's not a straightforward process. It can get fairly complex and there can be exceptions for individual words. So for arraigned, we want to shift the object of the preposition from a straight noun to an adjectival noun and then follow that always with the word charges. Always and never with anything else. Right? So there, it can get complex. Now, this works, but the problem, the reason this isn't going to be particularly useful, it's going to give us some insight on how to build our database, but we can't build a semantic grammar using the entire language because we couldn't analyze the entire language to do this. Now, if we wanted to start, if we only wanted to pick a vocabulary of 20,000 words, which isn't a lot, I mean, we would have just an enormous analytical challenge ahead of us, and we just simply couldn't do it. Right? Now, there's a solution. I use this concept, but in a different kind of way in the software that's running in the other room. Now, the aesthetic limitations to NLG are two. First of all, what I just said, semantic grammars only work for very small application domains. You know, it's like a weather system, you know, a health information system, you know, various kinds of, you know, very small specialized vocabularies work. They don't work for the broader language. So that's, you know, pretty easy to see. But there's a more insidious and very subtle problem with trying to use NLG in aesthetic text generation. And that is that the goal of NLG systems is communication. Clear, precise, exact communication. When the weather channels it's on the 8th where I live. And if you miss it by a minute, you miss it, so now you got to go get another cup of coffee and wait for it to roll around again. Right? You don't want it to say, it's as cool outside as the dock in front of my lake house in the mountains. You don't want it to say that. You want it to say, it's 48 degrees. Right? You want to know what it is. Right? But we don't want poetry like that. You know, poetry is at its best when it's ambiguous, when it's nuanced, when it's complex, when it's amenable to interpretation, when people argue about it, when undergraduates say, but that's not what it means to me. Right? Okay. So NLG can give us some direction, but it's not going to give us an answer. All right. So my answer, and I want to stress that this is one answer. This isn't the answer to this problem, and an analog is this cube in here. I mean, these two exhibits are very, very similar in that the cube if you haven't seen this, there's water in a plexiglass cube that evaporates and then comes down the sides in different shapes. It's infinitely varied, right? So we have these this visual art, right, that is never the same. In essence, creating paintings. Now, there could be other answers. If that cube were colored, we'd have a different experience with it. If it were set on one of its corners, we'd have a different experience. If it were a sphere, we'd have a different experience. So there are different solutions to this problem. This is mine. Right? Now, ETC, Electronic Text Composition Project, also are the initials of my pseudonym, Erica T. Carter, who's managed to get a few things published with this, consists of two major components, a lexical database and an analytic grammar. Now, the lexical database I built from two sources. The first was the British National Corpus, which is a set of texts which have been tagged by part of speech. Right? So every word in that corpus is tagged. And the corpus comes from a lot of sources, newspapers, journals, novels, recorded conversations, just, you know, an abundance of different kinds of texts. So it really is representative of the language, kind of this linguistic ether that's brushing past us all the time. And I took those. The British National Corpus has 100 million words. About 15 million of those were not useful because they were in headings or some other way. So I ended up with 85 million words in not quite 6 million sentences. And went through and processed that and stored these in a database. The database actually has 28 tables, so it's much more complex than this. But there are generally two kinds of tables, an analytic set of tables. So there's a lexicon with about 400,000 words in it. There's this verb frame. I'll tell you where that came from in a second. Context bigrams. There are a set of tables which define relationships between words. A bigram is a pair of words, right, in some relationship to one another. And they don't have to be adjacent, right? They can be far apart as long as they have some relationship. Subject verb, for example, all right? A preposition object, adverb verb, right? So we have tables that store all these kinds of relationships. And it'll be clear as to why you do that later. The context bigram table is the most expansive table, has 45 million rows in it. So this is a non-trivial application. Right? The other source is WordNet, which is a linguistic database from Cognitive Center at Princeton, which is lists of synonyms and the relationships to one another. Right? And one of the things it has is verb frames is an interesting table, is that WordNet defines 35 different possible sentence structures, right? Not the four that we learned in high school, right? But it's 35 different verbs, and what verbs can fit into what. That enables me in the program to say this verb should have this, be surrounded by this kind of grammar. Right? Now the other part is an analytic grammar, and Ms. Soppet would be very proud to know that I still remember the symbols for diagramming, so I can put this up here. And that lives in the program itself. So the rules of the grammar are embedded in the program, which utilizes the database for its content. Okay. Now, we're going to get just a little technical, no more than absolutely necessary, so that we don't have to talk about the technical components in our conversation. Okay? So that's kind of like a directive. Okay. All right. This is a section, a very small section, of the context bigram table. And what we have here is the word green as an adjective, and all of the nouns in the corpus with which it appears. Now, I have defined the boundary in which bigrams appear as the sentence, which is kind of counterintuitive. In previous versions of the software, the words had to be adjacent to one another. The problem there is it didn't get enough bigrams, right? And through experimentation, the sentence seems to be an appropriate boundary to give us enough normalcy so that the sentences seem natural, but enough variation to give us that unreasoned component to poetry that Barbara Smith was talking about. So you see in the corpus, green appears with tree 159 times. Now this is out of 85 million words, 6 million sentences. Only 159 sentences contain the word green and tree. Kind of, you know, the computational linguist mantra, all words are rare. Okay. Now here, green and arse appear twice, right? Probably near the same sentences that have green and beer. So the idea is that the grammar can select words based on their probability, based on the frequencies of individual pairs in the database. Now what I've done here is given the 10 most frequent and the 10 least frequent. Okay. This is where it gets interesting. These are the most frequent bigram associations of a noun with the adjective green. And you see it happens 305 times. So now say that the machine were attempting to construct a noun phrase and was required to construct that noun phrase using the adjective green. All right? It would go to the database and then add up all of these frequencies to get a total weight, right? And then do a calculation, and based on that weighted, it select randomly based on those weights one of these words. So it's 305 times more likely to get I than plundering. Right? Now, here's where, again, I said this gets interesting. The average number of bigrams containing the adjective green and a noun is 4. Right? It's 4, only 4. Right? There are 7,100 different bigrams with green as an adjective and a noun. 3,600 of them only appear once. All right? Okay, so now, right, if you do a calculation, I actually did these calculations. I mean, it took 1 hour to run this query. And so, right. That's why I'm marginally prepared tonight, because you're running these queries this way. All right, there's a 20% chance that the grammar will get a usage that's less than average. So about one-fifth of the time, it's going to get a rare use of the word green associated with a noun. And that is enough to introduce a little linguistic distortion into the text and make it seem unreasoned at particular times without allowing it to fall over into gibberish. Okay, clever. Isn't that clever? Okay. All right. Now, that's the database. And I know this is very small text. This is a class diagram of the machine's internal grammar. I'll explain what a class is briefly. This is only a partial diagram. The machine has, or the grammar contains 110 discrete classes. So also, this is a non-trivial application. Okay. Now, a class in a computer program can think of as a discrete piece of the program that's intended to model something in the real world. Right? In this case, we're going to model poems, utterances, constituents, and words. Right? So this class, this is kind of an interesting concept, is that a class can contain two kinds of attributes. One are the characteristics of the entity we're trying to model. Right? So in the case of a poem, if one of these it can be number of lines, right? So that's a characteristic of a poem. So we can set that value and say, we want a poem to have 14 lines. So that's a characteristic of that. Okay? And the other kind of attribute that it can have is a behavior. And we refer to that as a method, right? Something that the class can do. So in these classes, we have, and I know this is very small, we have a number of methods, realize semantics. And that's equivalent to the, and this is borrowed, right, from the field of natural language generation. This is equivalent to the microplanner, where we're writing individual sentences. So this class has a behavior, and it has another realized surface and another realized form. Right? So these are things that the poem can do. Right? Now, when we have a class, the class really is a set of rules that define the way objects of that type can be brought into existence. So we can have a class computer, right? And that has some attributes. It has a clock speed. It has, you know, a memory, you know, capacity, and all these other kinds of things. And then this is an instance of a computer. So that becomes the object. So when I talk about an object, I'm talking about one of the things that really exists. And when I talk about a class, it's the abstraction that defines those rules. And one of the things that's really cool about objects is that they can contain attributes or properties, right, which are other classes. Right? So that makes this conceptually very simple. You know, so you know, all the people that have been telling you the computer programming was hard have been lying to you. Okay? Right? They don't want you to know how easy it is, because you can just charge obscene amounts of money to do it. And they want to charge you, they don't want you charging them. And by the way, I'll tutor people on computer programming for an equally obscene charge. Okay. All right, anyway, so the poem has as one of its properties a list of utterances, right? And so we have the, now this diagram is a little whacked. It should be across this way, but to get it on the screen, I had to make it circular like this. And the utterance contains a list of constituents. So an utterance could be a sentence, and the constituents could be a subject and a predicate, could be a subject, a verb phrase, and a prepositional phrase, and so on. And the constituents are a little interesting in that they can contain lists of themselves. So they're a little bit self-referential, which is, I guess, pretty cool in this postmodernist world. Okay. And the constituents, in turn, contain lists of words. So we have this structure, the poem, with lists of utterances, with lists of constituents, with lists of words. The interesting part is utterances know how to construct themselves. And that simply is they know what constituents they can be made of. So they construct the utterances, the constituents. The constituents know what they can be made out of, which are words. So they go to the database and get that, completely independent of any intelligence in the poem. The poem's just simply telling these objects perform these behaviors. Right? So once this is all working, it's kind of like, you know, a Rube Goldberg machine. It just works. Right? And we get the output. But this is insufficient, woefully insufficient, to give us something that approximates a composition. Because we still have the same problem, is we have random utterances. How do they stitch together to make some kind of cohesive sense? Right? Okay. Now, the one way that this works is that the poem, you have to jumpstart the poem. You give it a few words, half a dozen words, 20 words, one word, whatever you want, and it will use those words as the core for its utterances. Now, it may or may not use those. It may go out to the database and say, give me some related words, and construct its utterances from those. But it has to have a start. Okay. Now, I knew that I needed some kind of discourse planner in this, but I could never figure out how to make it work. And I only really got this working a couple of months ago, just in time for this exhibit. Okay. So the way this works is there's this discourse planner object. And when the poem is instantiated, it instantiates a discourse planner. So you see discourse planner is one of its properties embedded inside it. Now, you can envision all kinds of planners. The only one I have working that's working on all these machines is a framed discourse where the poem begins and ends with a similar semantic reference. Okay? And the way that is effected, this is very elegant, I'm particularly proud of this, okay, is that the poem hands off its seed words to the discourse planner, which then elaborates on that and creates what's called a word pool, which is larger than the seed word, so that we get a little bit more variation in the poem. All right? And so people say, well, how come it didn't use my seed word? And then a part of that, it's called an instantiation, the creation of this object. Part of that instantiation tells the discourse planner how many lines the poem plans to write. And then every time it writes a line, it has to go to the discourse planner and say, give me some words that I may use. So when it's the first line, the discourse planner gives it one word and says, use this word. It's very autocratic. So it uses that word in an utterance. And then when it goes for the second, it gets the whole pool, the third, fourth, fifth, up to the nth, in this case the 14th, in which case it gives back the first word again, and so you must use this word, and we get a framed composition. Now, you can envision all kinds of ways of doing this. What you could do is we could build a word pool of synonyms of seed words, and say we have a 16-line poem. The first eight, or some random value, could be from those seed words, and then the second from antonyms. So we've got a hinged poem, right? And we can envision different kinds of stanzaic structures based on that, general to specific, part to whole. And if you think of it, I can code it. Right? All right. So now with that, that was the last piece of the puzzle that makes this monstrosity work. Okay. So now it works. You've got to trust me that it works. And I want to talk here. Now, we're almost done. Thank God. See? We're almost done. But I want to talk about the texts. Right? So we've moved from science now to art. And we're archiving all these things. These poems that are piled up on the table, they're yours. They're public domain. These have been... these machines have been writing, composing these poems over the last couple of weeks. We consider them public domain. Take them, incorporate them, use them, steal from them, you know, whatever you want to do. This is one of them, and when it prints, it gives us the time. It was working very late that night. The machines in there are running automatically, so you can't seed them for every poem. So what we've done is we've put into the database lists of pre-seeded, pre-lists of seed words that it can select from. And I just took those from various texts. This from The Dead, the last paragraph of The Dead, I took every adjective, verb, and noun out of there and put them in the database. And it selects six words, and here, these are the words that it selected. Abstraction index is a property of the poem. The higher that value, as that number approaches 100, the certainty that it will not print a complete sentence approaches 1. Right? And the lower that number, the more likely that it will write a sentence. And then we have this lyric index, where it will do things like append participial phrases, or it'll incorporate a simile, or a couple other things like that. And then it can quote. There's a database of real poems, and it quoted down here, puts it in italics, and it attributes it to T.S. Eliot under the glazing shelves. So here's a poem, The Silver Chaplet. Silvery water gets, now it says silvery water. An MFA cliche. Okay? So let's keep going here. By the way, I did a web search on silvery water and poem. I got 400 hits, including Hiawatha, Longfellow's, right? Under the willow tree or something with it, right? Silvery water gets to the new string. All right, so kind of interesting there. All right, scenting. And it's a some renewed sense, built, nears an expansion, knowing, approaches assistance generous, or implies a century late, or implies management active. Thoughts, nears thoughts specific, tellings other, approaches, and then the quote upon the glaze, and so on. And we keep going. Sense after a course gets the extent like a batsman, nears a tunnel, the mind, special attention, and pins, a shave, the record player, the laugh. Now, I read this the first time, I thought that there's some stemming errors in my software. I thought that must have been lathe. And I said, aha, parataxis. I know what that is, right? That's a postmodernist cliche. So why don't we see. And then we end up ever becoming emotions like his mortality, silvery water. So we have the frame. Now, there are folks who think that we should stop here. That the machine should stand by itself. But I can't resist the urge to tinker. Right? So I played with this poem, changed some things around, added a word or two of my own, changed the grammar. Silvery water, new strings, and the sense of renewal, right? Built near. An expansion knowing the implication of the late century's generosity. A little enjambment never hurts, but active and specific, tellings other approaches. Watching, change the quote to a reference, watching among the glazed shells for sense, for a course, for the sense after a course. And if you notice, we have this pun on sense and sense. It's machine doing its Charles Bernstein imitation here, right? Things near the, watching among the glazed shells for sense, for a course, for the sense after a course. Things near the mind's tunnel bearing special attention. Pins, a shade, the record player, the lathe, and I like the assonance there, so I kept that. Ever becoming, like her mortality, like silvery water. Right? Now, you pay your money and you take your choice, okay? Some folks are going to like this, and some folks are going to like this, and I'm really not sure which I like. But the point of this is that the machine poetry can reside in your imagination the way you wish. It can either be an end or it can be a beginning. But it really facilitates the imagination. It really is a prosthetic imagination. Now, I have to just give me a second here. Returning finally to Barbara Smith, and I think we have found this country. Art inhabits the country between chaos and cliche. We don't want everyday discourse. In fact, a problem is the more fluent the software becomes, the less poetic it is. If the truth be told, I like the last version of the software better, which was very, very rough, didn't do surface realization, didn't rationalize articles, misspelled all kinds of things, didn't punctuate, but it startled. So it's kind of, as the poetry gets more fluent, it finds itself falling off Emerson's stairway of surprise. Okay. Now, in the spirit of fun, and being mindful that that's what this is supposed to be, right? I thought it would be interesting to read one of the pieces that I'm most fond of. Okay, this was from the previous version of the software, and I seeded this. I tended to work on these things when I was very tired, and I'm not sure if that was good or not. And I, for some reason, I seeded it with some unusual words, with dragon, smoke, ice, and some other strange things. And I got back these unsettling images, right? But interspersed within them was interjected the adjective snappy, right? Several times, about half a dozen times, completely inappropriate. And at first I discarded that, but then the next day I picked it up and I took another look at it and realized, this is something that my own imagination would never make accessible to my whatever literary talent I have. Right? So I cleaned it up a little bit, did a little editing, moved some things around, and tried to exploit this snappy. Now, I should change clothes now. I should put on a black T-shirt and dungarees and tie a leather shoestring around my... put on a Mets cap. Now, I'm pretty sure I can get the professional reader's intonations down, but you're going to have to use your imagination on the uniform. Okay? No future but itself. Snappy. There is credit enough in the terse snow, in the corn on burnt knees thin as knives, discriminating, penetrative, snappy. There are dragons in the snow, too old and centered for ultimate answers, making their lives a mixture of myrrh, fantastic numbers, and sinners guessing their grades. Their needs matter, with the agamemnon lizard in deathly pale shadow, or by Coulomb signals, stabbing tracks in layered vessels at 7:30 on a Sunday morning, four jacks and a broken glass on the table, the low means of magic. Damned crisp. Snappy. A full bang-up sentence. A fussing laugh, laughed with mechanical foresight, electric current writhing like a snake, an ancient claim, a virtual eclipse, the words of serious commitment. A fresco dragonfly, new and available, soft in the hottest part of the deepest bone. Snappy. The necessary mythical creature remains to ride the ordinary. Mythical monster in powered descent, the flying dragon, the burial and complement of institutions' process. The laugh of an extraordinarily beautiful man is the laugh of percentage, is for its own sake. And the sake once felt, the book is tangent, spectrometric, rain in bottles, the year smoke came down about the housetops in Nagasaki. Snappy. And you don't really know whether to laugh or not on that last snappy, do you? Okay. So thank you for your very kind attention, and we're ready to start our conversation.